This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, Andrew West with you on Extra this week, filling in for Geraldine Doogue. It's great to have your company for the program ahead. You've almost certainly heard of the Cambridge Five spy ring, and even if you can't name all five, I'll bet you know the audacity of their espionage for the Soviet Union before, during, and just after World War II. But there was an even more daring spy, perhaps one even more damaging to Western interests. George Blake was born in the Netherlands. He spent a formative part of his youth in Egypt, transformed himself into an almost stereotypical Englishman, and then spent the last half century of his life in Russia, the country for which he had spied. He's the subject of a fascinating and really riveting new biography called The Happy Traitor, Spies, Liars and Exile in Russia, The Extraordinary Life of George Blake. And the author is Simon Cooper. He's a journalist with the Financial Times based in Paris. Simon, welcome to Saturday Extra.
Thank you very much.
Now, Simon, before we get into some of the intriguing details of it, of his life, it struck me, being a sort of an espionage tragic, that George Blake wasn't a spy for all that long, less than a decade. But why was he so consequential? What damage did he do to British and American intelligence?
Well, during the time he was spying for the KGB, 1953 to 1961, when he's exposed, he was working at MI6 head office in London. And so he had access to an enormous amount of files. And at lunch hour, he'd shut himself in his room and take out a miniature camera and photograph it and hand it on to his KGB handlers. He gave them the names of several hundred agents working for British MI6, mostly behind the Iron Curtain. MI6 later reckoned that 40 or so of these people had been executed by the Soviet spy services. And he also gave away the Berlin Tunnel, which the US and UK had dug under Berlin to spy on Soviet communications.
Yeah, I want to come back to the Berlin Tunnel because that is a really fascinating detail. To understand, though, George Blake's motive for espionage, or maybe his willingness to betray Britain, we need to know a bit about his background, which was a really fascinating cosmopolitan mix. What was it?
Yeah, Blake was not like most of the kind of British gentlemen who populated MI6 in those days. He was born in Rotterdam in 1922, a Dutch mother, and his father was a Jew from Constantinople who in World War I had fought for the French Foreign Legion and for the British Army, and that's how the father had become a British citizen, although he seems in his life always never to have visited Britain. And so George is born as George Behar, in Rotterdam, British citizen, and he grows up there. But when his father dies, when he's 12 or 13, he's packed off to the father's sister in Cairo, where he lives in this very cosmopolitan Jewish home where he learns fluent French and English at schools there. And so by the end of his teens, he's turned from a kind of very pious Dutch Calvinist into a very worldly young man, and that's when World War II breaks out.
Yeah, but you say that he's turned from a pious Dutch Calvinist, but the thing that keeps coming back to me during this really riveting book, Simon, is that he never, even when he's committed himself to the Soviet Union, he never really gives up that Dutch Calvinism.
Yeah, I think that worldview shaped him to the end of his life, and it also helped lead him on to communism, because he did start to doubt that Jesus was the Son of God, but he always, I think, remained in his bones a Calvinist. He believed that everything was predetermined, there is God's hand that guides all our actions, so nothing we do is our own choice, which, of course, was very reassuring to him after he'd you know, done these terrible things in his life, to think, well, I was just God's vessel. I had no choice in it. And also he saw the similarities between Calvinism and communism. That's what led him to communism. Calvinism believes in equality. It doesn't like material display. And it believes in a paradise in the afterlife. And communism doesn't like material display, believes in equality, and believes in a paradise here on this earth. So it was very easy for him in later life to make that leap. And, you know, at the end of his life, I think the thing he was still most truly in his late 90s was a Calvinist.
Yeah, now George Blake serves in the British Navy in World War II. He's this brilliant linguist. He masters six languages. He joins the British Foreign Secret Service, MI6. 1948, he is sent to South Korea. How is his life turned upside down by the Korean War?
Well, he's sent there more or less against his will because he doesn't speak Korean. He has no interest in the region. But the MI6 says to him, look, there's going to be a war in Korea between the North and the South, which are already divided. And we want you to stay there and observe that war. Britain will be neutral. But then when war does indeed break out in 1950, Britain actually goes into the war on the side of the US, you know, the first kind of British act of being a poodle to the US, which we've become familiar with.
And Australia was there too.
Also unfortunate.
Yes.
And Blake is very upset by this. You know, he realizes Britain is not a superpower anymore as he thought, but it's just America's sidekick. And then he is taken captive by the North Koreans with the other British diplomats. And he goes on this death march and he sees American bombers destroying Korean villages. And his sympathies start to turn against the Americans and towards the North Koreans. And then in captivity, he ends up in this quiet farmhouse. And the prisoners are sent some books by the Soviet embassy in Pyongyang, Robert Louis Stevenson's Treasure Island. They're very excited. They read it to pieces. And then two books in Russian, Marx's Capital in Russian and Lenin's State and Revolution. And Blake and the British consul, who can both read Russian, read these books. They read Capital twice. And Blake is convinced. He thinks, you know, communism is sort of Calvinism put into practice. And he falls for it.
Yeah, now this is very important because years later, it sparks this outburst that will actually doom him when he's questioned by British spy catchers. But why did George Blake actually go from prisoner of war in Korea across to the communist side? Did it have something to do with wanting a full stomach or not?
I don't think so. I mean, there's been this accusation that, I mean, at one point he tries to escape and the North Koreans catch him and they bring him back and they're very angry, but they don't kill him. And so there's speculation that he did a deal with them. He would spy for the communists in return for his life. But I think that they didn't kill him because they didn't want to take responsibility of killing a British diplomat. And the story he's told about his conversion rings true to the person he was all his life. This ideologue, this man who cared more about ideas and faith than about people. And so I find it very convincing. It's the story he's told all his life. And I think that is the man he was. Mm. He was a genuine communist.
This is Saturday Extra. Andrew West in for Geraldine. I'm speaking this week with Simon Cooper. He's the author of the new book, The Happy Traitor, Spies, Liars and Exile in Russia, The Extraordinary Story of George Blake. Now, perhaps, and you alluded to this earlier, Simon, his greatest achievement as a spy for the Soviet Union occurred when he was posted in Berlin in the 50s. Now, you've mentioned the Berlin spy tunnel or the Berlin tunnel. Exactly what was that and how instrumental was it to Western security operations?
Well, 1953-54, when they conceived this tunnel, is a terrifying moment in the Cold War because Stalin is dead. And with Stalin, at least they knew where they were. Stalin was a psychopathic killer, but he wasn't very interested in invading the West. But his successor, Khrushchev, is a kind of black box to the West. Is he a warmonger or does he want peace? Nobody knows. And the West have no spy assets really in senior positions behind the Iron Curtain. They don't know what the Kremlin is thinking. And so they hit on this plan in divided Berlin to build a spy tunnel about a kilometer long under Berlin from west to east so they can tap into Soviet phone calls and telegrams. And this is going to provide them with, you know, the knowledge they need. If the Soviets are going to invade, it's probably going to be through Berlin, through Germany at least. And even if they have a few hours warning, that could be the difference between winning or losing World War III. So they built this spy tunnel, but unfortunately, the secretary at the meeting where it's decided to build it, the man taking the minutes, is George Blake. So within a couple of days, the Soviets know about the spy tunnel. The KGB does, at least. But then the KGB has this terrible dilemma. Do we expose the tunnel? And then the US and UK will know that we have a mole and they might find Blake. Or do we protect our valuable mole at the heart of MI6 and not tell other Soviets, not tell the Red Army, for example, about this tunnel? And the KGB chooses the latter course. So almost nobody in the Soviet hierarchy is told about the tunnel. And for a year, the West is able to listen to totally genuine Soviet communications, which are very reassuring because it turns out they don't want a war. They're not planning a war.
Yeah. We have to leave some of this narrative for people to read because it really is terrific. But we should skip ahead. In 1961, George Blake is uncovered. He's sentenced to 42 years in jail, the longest sentence, I think, given to a spy. He goes to Wormwood Scrubs in suburban London. I believe he checked out early, Simon.
Yeah, he did not intend to stick around and do 42 years. So he finds some mates inside the jail. And in 1966, in this very amateurish, almost cartoonish escape, he gets over the wall with a rope ladder. He then has to jump down, breaks his wrist. But it's actually quite easy to escape from British jails in the 1960s. Dozens of people get out. He hides in a couple of London addresses, and then these peaceniks, these pacifists who met in jail, one of them drives him at the bottom of a camper van. They make this secret compartment from London to Berlin, where Blake manages to get into East Berlin.
Yeah, it struck me just how, I mean, you say it was comical, but I'd say it was comical more on the part of the British prison authorities. They just threw a rope ladder over, and he's on the other side of the wall. There appeared to be no sort of no man's zone between it. It struck me as very easy to get out.
It was very easy to get out. And I mean, from his prison alone, loads of people got out in 1966 alone. And, you know, unfortunately, as a result of his escape, British prisons became not just more secure, which they needed to be, but also more brutal places where, you know, prisoners couldn't do classes as easily, couldn't consort with each other as easily. So Blake's escape really had a damaging effect on British prisons. Mm.
Look, just as we wind up, Simon, you ended up spending a fair bit of time with George Blake in Moscow. He lived there for more than 50 years. And we should say George Blake died less than a year ago, I think, Boxing Day 2020. From your description of the long conversations you had with him, I did not get the impression of a malevolent man, even though he sort of boasted about how many people he'd betrayed. He seemed to me like a man with little loyalty to a country because he felt that he couldn't find a country.
He didn't have a country. I mean, he was a Dutch patriot, but he left the Netherlands at about 22 years old and never went back for the last 75 years of his life. And so, yeah, he didn't go back for the last 60 years of his life. And so, yeah, he was a rootless cosmopolitan. But I think more than that, he was a man who believed in ideas and causes, first Christianity and then communism. And you're right, he wasn't malevolent. I think Blake was a well-meaning man who thought that communism would make the world a better place. And his well-meaning intent led him to become a de facto serial killer with 40 people's blood on his hands. And he always denied to himself that the KGB had killed those people. He said he told the KGB not to hurt them. Of course, the KGB ignored that and did hurt them. But he was a kindly person who couldn't live with what he had done.
Mm. The thing is, he did seem to suggest to you that it had all been a waste. I got the impression in the closing pages of the book where he just thought this commitment to communism had been a waste.
Yeah, I mean, he said that within a week of arriving in Moscow in 1966-67, he realised that communism didn't work, that this was a grey, gloomy, poor, repressive place. And then he had to deal with, you know, the loss of that light. And, you know, he had no more illusions about communism. And so he'd given his family and his life to the wrong cause. But he felt, you know, communism is a good idea, and maybe in future centuries humanity will need it. But in his latter years, he turned away from ideas and became more of a family man. And he reconnected with his sons in Great Britain, who he hadn't seen for decades. And he kind of found pleasure in more simple things like music and his wife reading to him. So, you know, in the end, he gave up on the ideas.
Yeah, just before we go, it's important to point out he actually spent most of his time in Russia after it ceased to be a communist country. I think it ceased to be a communist country Christmas Day 1991. What did he make of Russia under Boris Yeltsin and now Vladimir Putin?
Well, his condition for speaking to me for the long interview we had was that I wouldn't ask him about Putin. And the reason was that he detested Putin. He saw him as a cynical, murderous thug. But he didn't want to say that in an interview because he and his wife depended on Putin for their pension and their dacha. And Putin would occasionally, you know, speak warm words about George Blake, who has served our country. And so he thought it was all just terrible. He thought it was that the Soviet Union had degenerated into this cynical country that he felt no particular part of.
Very good to talk to you. Simon Cooper, he's a journalist with the Financial Times based in Paris. And Simon's latest book is The Happy Traitor, Spies, Lies and Exile in Russia, The Extraordinary Story of George Blake. Thank you for joining us on Saturday Extra.
Thank you very much.
And now grab your pens because you're about to get some recommendations on what to read, listen and watch. And now it's time for The Pick, where we get two very interesting chatty people to come on and share their recommendations on what to read or listen to or watch. You might want to put some of their recommendations into your list for the summer holidays ahead or simply get stuck in right now. Well, here to give us their culture picks this month are Dr. Lauren Richardson. She teaches at the ANU Department of International Relations and she's a director of the ANU Japan Institute. Welcome, Lauren.
Thanks for having me on your program.
And Bill Wyman, a former managing editor of National Public Radio in Washington, former arts editor of Salon, that wonderful online magazine. He still writes, although from Australia now, and he teaches at the University of Sydney. Bill, welcome to you.
Andrew, thank you so much for having me on.
Let's start with what's been teasing the ears, as it were. Lauren, you are a Japan and Korea expert, and your picks have a North Asian flavour. Your podcast recommendation, you've chosen South Korea's Hope in Hell. It's from the BBC. Tell us about it.
Yeah, well, what I find interesting about this is that South Korea is basically on a demographic collision course. They have the fastest shrinking population in the world, both a declining birth rate and a strongly aging society. And what's really driving this is just that life has become so hard in South Korea and so competitive that people have decided that their best option is to just not get married, not have kids, and not even date other people, which is kind of like resulted in the rise of singledom in South Korea. So this podcast really goes into great detail about, you know, what's going on in South Korean society that's driving this really interesting phenomenon.
Lauren, why does that have echoes to me of what I was reading about Japan 20 years ago? The very lonesome kind of person, the lonesome shut-in young person. Now we're seeing it in Korea. Is it the same phenomenon?
Yeah, it's a very similar phenomenon. Both Japan and South Korea have similar demographic trends. They're a little bit more advanced in South Korea than Japan. And so it really kind of makes one wonder if this is a trend that we're going to see in all other sort of advanced advanced economies, where the gap between rich and poor is growing really big, you know, the cost of living is accelerating. And it's become, those societies are very competitive, they're very hyper-educated. So if you have children, you're going to be forking out so much money to put them through cram school as well as normal school just so that they can succeed in life. And so people have just sort of thrown in the towel. And obviously the pandemic has accelerated that, people are putting off childbirth again. So both societies are on that course, but it is more pronounced in South Korea.
Now, Bill, your podcast favourite, I've heard it too, and it comes out of NPR, out of, I think, Los Angeles, All the President's Lawyers. What is it? Why is it on your list?
Well, it's really fascinating, and it's a production of KCRW, which is a public radio station out of Los Angeles, and it's sort of part of the NPR network, but I think technically it's not an NPR show, technically. But it's in this time of these vacuous talking heads, everyone just spewing all this nonsense about Trump and Biden and all sorts of things on all sorts of levels of ridiculousness. It's really refreshing to talk about a show that's run by two really smart people who are basically pretty objective and detached and about a very specific, useful subject. And it's specifically about the legal troubles around Donald Trump and to some extent now Biden. But it's been such a refreshing time to listen to because the host is Josh Barrow. He's just one of the smartest journalists around. And he actually has an interesting background kind of in almost in the Republican side of American politics, but sharp as a whip. And then his foil is this guy named Ken White, who used to be working in a U.S. attorney's office and now is in white collar practice. And what that means is that when you work for a U.S. attorney, you're dealing with the United States government pursuing bad guys on whatever level, whether civil or criminal. And it's a very specialized form of American legality, and it demands a lot of smarts.
I first heard All the President's Lawyers a few years ago, and I've got to say I was a bit wary because I thought, oh, do we need another podcast telling us the obvious that Donald Trump is a man seriously legally compromised? So I was a bit wary, but it has matured. The conversation's matured.
Yeah, it's really good. And I think this Ken White, who's very funny, and again, who's now on the defense side of federal law, he just knows so much about it. He's just seen all this stuff and he can just put things into context. And I think he's just always very fair. A lot of the times he'll say, think, yes, everyone's talking about this case. Everyone's wish casting, as he put it, that Trump's going to go to jail. But let me explain to you, you know, from the perspective of someone who understands federal prosecutions, why that won't happen. And he's also not ashamed at times to say, well, this is why people are going to go down on this. And he has a very, very high track record. And they've talked about a lot of legal poltroons, as you can imagine, from Rudy Giuliani to Michael Avenatti. And there's this ongoing joke where Josh Barrow will say to him, he'll say, Ken, is Michael Avenatti a good lawyer? And this is when Avenatti's, you know, being pursued by three separate federal jurisdictions. And Ken will kind of shake his head and sigh and say, Josh, I don't think so.
Rudy Giuliani, the gift that keeps on giving. Okay, from the ear to the eye, let's move on to what you're reading. Lauren, two Japanese books on your list, both focus on the role of women in Japanese society. Tell us about The Stranger in Shogun City by Amy Stanley.
Yeah, so this is a brilliant book that just came out last September, September 2020. And what's interesting about it is that it was published by an academic, a professor of Japanese history at Northwestern University in the United States. And it's interesting because it has all the rigor of a normal academic history book, but it's written for sort of a general audience. So it's incredibly readable and incredibly engaging. And it's based on, I mean, from a research perspective, it's a really great achievement because she's used all notes from the woman who it centers on, letters that she wrote in the 19th century. And they're written, you know, in that kind of very scribble Japanese script that's extremely hard to read. So the author not only has had to learn regular Japanese, but also classical Japanese, and also how to decipher that scribble kind of script. And she's pieced it all together to come up with this fascinating story of a woman who really defied, you know, the norms of what's expected of women in early Japanese society, and really was rebellious in many ways.
What about your second book, The Doctor's Wife by Soeko Ariyoshi? It was published in the 70s, but you've gone back to it as almost a Japanese classic.
Yeah, that's right. I think there's something about the borders being closed, international borders being closed, not being able to go back to Japan and instead having to try to immerse myself in these books. So I decided to reread this book last year, which I first came across about 10 years ago. And it's fascinating. Again, this one's more loosely based in history. It's set a century earlier than the other one, this one in the 18th century. And it's based on the kind of historical part of it is it centers partly on a surgeon who was experimenting with anesthesia, how to develop anesthesia. And he used general anesthetic, performed general anesthetic long before any doctor in the West. And so the fictional part revolves around his wife, the relationship between him, his wife, and her mother-in-law. So as was customary in that time, women, when they got married, moved in with the husband's family. And so because the husband's very ambitious and he's always traveling and, you know, collecting plants that he wants to use for his experiments, both the wife and the mother-in-law sort of vie for his affections. And it's a really interesting dynamic.
Now, Bill, you, along with many other things, have been a rock critic for a lot of your professional life, so it's no surprise that you've picked a book by, I think he was with the New York Times for a long time, Rick Bragg.
Exactly. It's a sort of a semi-autobiography and sort of a biography by this noted writer of Jerry Lee Lewis, and it's called Jerry Lee Lewis, His Own Story. And boy, it is a crazy hell of a tale, as you can imagine.
Like Jerry Lee Lewis was.
Exactly. And in one thing you might not have noticed, but Little Richard passed away this year or this last year. And he and Jerry Lee Lewis were the very last of the original promulgators of rock and roll from the 1950s. Chuck Berry's gone. Bo Diddley's gone. All those people. Fats Domino. And Jerry Lee Lewis is the last man standing. And what your audience might not know, if you don't know about Jerry Lee Lewis, is the reason we're laughing is that he's known as this wild man of rock and roll. A whole lot of shaking going on, great balls of fire. They sort of define the outer extremity of 50s rock, which is really saying something. But he also had a very, very, very crazy life. And I'll tell you one thing you know, and I'll tell you a footnote to it, that the thing he's really famous for, unfortunately today, is that he got married to a 13-year-old cousin. And he took her out on tour with him to England and quickly found out that in England, well, that was entirely, I have to say, in his defense, I don't want to say defense, but in Louisiana, which is a part of the Deep South in America where he grew up, marriage on that level was not considered bad at all. It was typical. His sister got married at 12. So I let's give him that. But then he found out that the rest of the world did not accept that, and it basically vaporized his career. Now, the footnote to that, which I delight telling people, is that she was 13, he was 21, and she was his third wife. So this is a guy who was embarking on this sort of weird stuff very early on. He ended up with about seven. It's widely assumed he killed his fifth wife, and he is, what, 90 now, and he is a very angry, unhappy man to this day, but he is the last man standing of rock and roll.
What a conflicted but compelling story. Rick Bragg's Jerry Lee Lewis biography, His Own Story. Very quickly, unfair because we don't have a lot of time, but Lauren, you've been watching a Korean TV series. I love the premise of this because it's got a bit of geopolitics in it. Crash Landing on You. What's that about?
Right. So this is on Netflix. It's one of the most popular Korean dramas. And as we all know, there's so many good Korean dramas out there. But it's basically, the basic plot line is that a woman from a very rich family in South Korea, they own one of those conglomerates like Samsung or one of them where they have a lot of concentrated wealth. She goes paragliding one weekend, and while she's up in the air, a tornado sweeps in and she is flung across the country and wakes up. She's been unconscious for some time in a tree, and she's basically on the northern side of the demilitarized zone, so essentially North Korea. And the series unpacks what happens from then. It's set mostly in North Korea. It's fascinating.
And Bill, you're a fan of the Indigenous Australian filmmaker Ivan Sen, and you've been watching some of his movies. What in particular?
Exactly. He's so interesting. And I happened upon Mystery Road and I thought, wow, that is one hell of a controlled exposition of sort of noir sensibility set in this very cool atmosphere, of course, and with a really great, compelling person. And then I saw Goldstone and thought, wow, this guy's really good. And then I went back to Tumala and started experiencing some of his earlier films. And Tumla, if you don't know, is a portrait of young indigenous youth, handheld camera, very artsy, very up in your face, very heartbreaking. And I thought, wow, this is a guy who has a lot of skill. You look into him, he writes, produces, directs, films, and edits his own movies, and he writes the score. So this is a guy who is doing things very few people in the world do. And my understanding is his next movie is set in the future and set in Hong Kong, and it's a love story. So I think we're going to see him expand his palette even further going forward.
Wow, what did they say? He sings, he dances, he writes, he does it all. Look, no, that's terrific, Bill. Lovely to talk to you both. Lauren Richardson, she's director of the ANU's Japan Institute, and Bill Wyman, formerly of National Public Radio and Salon Magazine, now teaching at the University of Sydney. Thanks for joining us on Saturday Extra.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
And we'll put a list of all of those picks for you up on our website. And that is all we have time for today, though. If you've missed any of our interviews, you can find them on the website or at the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts. A lot of interest in our interview with Emma Connors in Singapore about Asia's COVID waste crisis. I think it was Kate who said, please cut the ear loops off when you're throwing away the masks. They do terrible things to the environment and to the wildlife that might swallow them. It's a terrific pleasure to be with you. It's a terrific pleasure to work with this wonderful team, Sky Doherty, Taryn Priadko, Margie Smithurst, and engineer Hamish Camilleri. You've been listening to Extra with Andrew West, in for Geraldine Doogue. She'll be back with you at the same time next week.
Listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.